The Bigger Picture. Going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.
As many of that opinion say aye.
Aye.
Of the contrary, no. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. If you're buying.
It is time to talk politics and what politics there are. At the moment, we have been joined by Mike Indian, who is political commentator, author of the Groucho Tendency blog. Mike, it's given that we haven't seen each other since before the election, it is hard to know where to start.
Goodness me, Simon, where do we begin indeed?
Our most recent thing, I suppose, the Queen's speech. So
yes.
Perhaps we'll work our way backwards from that. Clearly, last time we saw each other, we assumed the Conservatives were going to romp home with a reasonable majority. And then, we had what, presumably, you would agree, one of the most inept political campaigns we can remember.
Absolutely staggering. It's got to be one of the biggest reverses of fortune in modern political history. You mentioned the Queen's speech there. Theresa May prefaced it by saying in her introduction, and part of the wonderful pack I have in front of me, "The election result was not the one I hoped for." Probably the understatement of the century so far, I think.
Yeah, so possibly was the one that Labour hoped for, though to some extent, of course, they've almost been treating it as that they've sort of won the election, which is not quite true. But perhaps we'll come on to talk about that later. Let's then think about what actually was in the Queen's speech and perhaps, as importantly, what wasn't.
Well, to put this in context here, we have a two-year parliamentary session, 2017 to 19, being proposed.
Yes, because we're not going to get a Queen's speech next year.
No, we won't
get
a Queen's speech next year. And it, in total, taking all the various bits of the package that Theresa May announced, she's proposing 27 bills, and it's including four draft, three finance bills in a two-year period. David Cameron put forward double that number in two parliamentary sessions when he was leading a majority Conservative government. So you really get a sense of how pared back the Tory manifesto has been. But there's still a lot in there, as you say. Eight Brexit bills, the key bits of her reforms, for example, on tenant fees as well, but a lot's gone. Social care reform is now a consultation. Grammar schools ditched entirely. And of course, we don't yet know what concessions, if any, the DUP have extracted out of the Tories for those 10 crucial votes in the Commons in the coming weeks and months.
You say a lot was gone. Before we go into the detail, of course, a lot was gone actually from the ceremony itself. I mean, the Queen was in mufti.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have a consort by her side, but had Prince Charles instead. She arrived in a car, no horse-drawn carriage. It didn't stop, of course, Dennis Skinner passing the usual the usual comment. This, we're told, was had something to do with the timing and the fact there wasn't time, really available time to get everything in order because of rehearsing from Trooping the Colour. I don't know whether that's right or not.
If you just do a little wander, as I do occasionally, down the back of St James's Park, it's all still been set up for that. The rehearsals have been underway. And, of course, it's Royal Ascot this week as well. So the Queen, Skinner's remark was, "Get your skates on, the race is starting at 2:30. So it's probably, sorry to Dennis Skinner for that horrendous impression. But we have, you know, it seems to fit with the times as well. The Tories were expecting to sweep to power, and now they have to be rather more conciliatory and modest, as was the pared back Queen's speech we had this week.
Okay, well, let's then have a look at the most important thing, I suppose, from the government's point of view, is enacting those, you say, eight Brexit bills, of which presumably the first and the biggest is the repeal bill, which we'd already heard a little about.
Yes, so the repeal bill is no longer great, as was the running joke through the this particular Queen's speech. We also had the customs bill as well, as was expected, the trade bill, the immigration bill, fisheries, agriculture, nuclear safeguards and international sanctions. This is the baseline of just covering what needs to be done for Brexit here. And the government always was clear it was going to go ahead with the Great Repeal Bill, but we're in this rather remarkable situation now where a minority government is about to do what is potentially, people have mooted, as the biggest legislative exercise in recent history, transposing thousands, possibly tens of thousands of EU laws into UK law and handing itself potentially sweeping powers to bypass Parliament and amend existing laws to fit in with the new regime.
Now, in the previous Parliament, one got the impression that Labour was going to go along with pretty much everything, and that the problem might come from the Lords. Do you get the impression now that Labour's perhaps not going to be quite as acquiescent?
We're going to see an alternative Labour agenda proposed before the end of this Queen's Speech debate. The Parliament debates it for 6 days. Next Thursday, there will be amendments moved by the Leader of the Opposition and, most crucially, probably the Leader of the DUP in Westminster, Nigel Dodds, and his cohort of MPs. Jeremy Corbyn's already made it clear that he will put forward key points from his manifesto to amend the motion, the common sense, back to the Queen. Now, this will be the first big test of Theresa May's authority, and it should be clear there's some constitutional ambiguity over whether she even has the right to put forward a Queen's speech in the first place. She has to have what's called confidence of the House, which means a majority. She hasn't formed a coalition with the DUP. She hasn't even agreed a deal with them yet. Yet she has proposed a Queen's speech. So it'll be a very nervous 7 days for the Prime Minister, waiting from the time when the monarch announced the speech on Wednesday, the 21st, to the vote, I think, which will be next on Thursday, the 28th, to put in context. Jeremy Corbyn will be putting forward amendments for his own key programme. Expect lifting of the public sector pay cap to be in there. Key points including workers' rights guaranteed when leaving the European Union. Housing will feature, obviously, given the sad events of last week at Grenfell Tower. If that's voted upon, that's going to be seen as Theresa May losing any sign that she can even get this minimalistic legislative agenda through in this extended parliamentary session, Simon.
Yes, I don't even want to contemplate what might happen then. But even if she manages to get the Commons to pass this, don't we then get the problem that the Lords might get, to put it mildly, a bit uppity? You explain to me what the Salisbury Convention is.
So this is an understanding that's existed. It's not written down anywhere. It's an understanding that was reached after the Second World War, when there was a landslide majority for Clement Attlee's Labour government, but the Conservatives dominated the House of Lords, as they did for most of the 20th century and even until this decade, with a majority of peers. There was an understanding that peers would not propose significant amendments or oppose at second reading or third reading bills or measures that could be connected to the government of the day's manifesto. And it's been governed. It was named after Lord Salisbury, who was the Conservative leader of the Lords at the time. And it's governed how the chamber and the upper and lower house of parliament have interacted over pretty much the last 60, 70 years. What is less clear is how this functions in relation to a minority government. It was founded on the basis that a government that has an overwhelming majority in the Commons can demonstrate democratic primacy over the unelected House of Lords. Theresa May cannot do that. She did not get a majority of votes at the election. She got 42-point-something% of the vote. I think it was 42.2% of the vote. She has less than half the MPs. The last time we had a hung parliament, this wasn't a problem. David Cameron simply formed a deal with the Liberal Democrats and Conservative peers, but the Lib Dem peers gave him a majority in the upper house. Mrs. May hasn't got that option this time round. So the applicability of the Salisbury Convention is shaky at best.
And the composition of the House of Lords is not very Conservative friendly.
No, there are 255 Conservative peers and DUP peers combined. There are only three DUP peers. So even if they had formed a proper coalition, they still would have been deprived of a Lords majority. There are a total of about 350 Labour and Lib Dem peers in the House as well. So already they're facing an uphill battle, which means most likely if any bills begin in the House of Lords, significant lobbying will be done by both the government and the opposition benches of the 140-something crossbenchers and the 30-or-something unaffiliated peers that sit in the House of Lords as is.
Now, after the election, well, surprise result to most people, we were given the impression that there was going to be a coalition almost immediately with the DUP. That hasn't happened. What's the current state, and what is the sticking point?
The sticking point really is, I think, exactly what the DUP is going to extract in exchange for its support. Now, BBC's Newsnight reported earlier this week that the DUP was potentially seeking £2 billion worth of spending commitments, whereas the government was proposing a much lower figure of £750 million here. Now, I was reading a fascinating series of tweets after the election from Luke Skipper, who's the SNP Westminster Group's former chief of staff. He now works as a lobbyist. And his perception was, as a smaller party who's dealt with the DUP on a number of occasions, particularly the Whip's office or the usual channels, as it's called, that the DUP are seasoned operators. They have a robust group of 10 MPs here. They know exactly what they want. Now, traditional Conservative governments under John Major could rely on the much more emollient UUP, but the UUP no longer has any MPs. And anyway, the DUP has overtaken them to be the unionist voice in Westminster now. They're far more socially conservative than the Conservative Party's policies have been in recent years. They have an agenda in terms of trying to extract concessions, particularly, for example, retention of older people's benefits. The triple lock abandonment has left the manifesto now. They'll retain that policy, even though Philip Hammond and May wanted to scrap it. Winter fuel payment means testing's gone as well. They want things like devolution of corporation tax to Northern Ireland, reduction in air passenger duty. The question is, how far will the Conservatives go to guarantee this deal? And the fact is that we are 2 weeks on from this election, pretty much at the time we are recording this, and there is no sign of any movement here. And most tellingly, on the weekend after the election, Downing Street confirmed a deal had been done, the DUP denied a deal had been done, then Downing Street issued a retraction, and we're still, a week and a half later, no clearer to understanding if, when the Conservatives have to file through the lobbies on the 28th of June, they will be able to count on those 10 votes to give them that working majority of 6 seats in the House.
Yes, we don't often hear the phrase strong and stable at the moment, do we? And presumably, if the deal is not somehow done with the DUP, who clearly have the government over a barrel, then is there any possibility of doing a deal with anybody else that would help the government? I mean, there's some talk that possibly the Lib Dems might not be quite as averse as they were. We don't actually know who the new leader of the Lib Dems is going to be yet.
No, Tim Farron's going to be leading the party until next month, mid-July. And he's obviously had a very difficult few months with the election campaign, and his party's got to do some sorting. But they do have more seats in the DUP. But there's no room to work with the Lib Dems on this either, really, Simon. Basically because, quite simply, their stance on Brexit is too different to the Conservatives. Yes. They've already tabled amendments demanding guaranteeing of workers' rights with some Labour MPs and staying in the single market, crucially, as well. So the Conservatives' best chance of getting through, the DUP does share their vision of Brexit, broadly speaking. Although, interestingly, they favour favour a soft border with Northern Ireland. Possibly the easiest way of achieving that is remaining inside the customs union. The DUP says it wants to leave that, probably demonstrating they haven't really thought through the implications of what they really want in terms of transitioning to reality after we leave the European Union here.
That's an odd thought, the idea of associating various forms of Brexit with not having thought things through properly. I've never heard that in any other quarter whatsoever. So we don't really think that there's any imminent press conference to be held in the Rose Garden as that famous one with...
No, I would expect a one-page release stating we're dealing with what's called a confidence supply agreement here. Now, someone earlier this week put it to me that the DUP have expressed confidence in the Conservative government, but they haven't yet stated that they will supply the votes here. Arlene Foster, the DUP's leader and erstwhile First Minister of Northern Ireland, suggested that it would be right and proper to back a Conservative Queen's speech. But also their chief whip, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, has said today, well, actually, do you know what? There may be amendments to which the DUP might also feel they can throw their weight behind here. The Conservatives aren't working with natural allies that they can count on here. I don't envy the job of the new chief whip trying to get these people through his lobbies. Gavin Williamson has a very tough job ahead of him.
Well, in a moment, let's look at some of the possible outcomes to what is currently going on.
Very good.
We are talking politics. With me is Mike Indian, political commentator, author of the Groucho Tendency blog. Mike, we should, I suppose, speculate then about what some of the possible outcomes are. I mean, there may be a deal with the DUP in some way, but it's not going to make the government seem stronger at all, because they will be having to give away so many concessions. What other possibilities are there if they can't do that? You were talking before about whether Theresa May actually does have the right to govern.
Well, this thing, and this comes back to a bit of guidance issued by the Cabinet Office in 2008, I think, which states that in the case of a minority government or a hung parliament, it's the incumbent prime minister who remains in office as a sort of caretaker role, and they specified that the election rules basically of purdah, where the government cannot issue anything else other than significant national or international decisions, remains in force. Now, Theresa May returned to Downing Street on the morning afterwards. She claimed that she had the right to govern. She said about appointing a government in that way. She basically carried on as if everything, some people said, as if everything was normal, except that she didn't have a majority anymore. Now, it should be clear the Conservatives did get the most seats and a record high vote share and number of votes at this election. She won more votes than John Major did in 1992 when he squeaked home with a 21-vote majority there. But Labour came a very close second.
21 seats.
Exactly, sorry, 21 seats, I should say, sorry. I was thinking of Pete Wishart in Perth and North Perthshire. But what we have now is a scenario where she's acting as if she, as some people claim she has the right to do, and we've talked about the Salisbury Convention earlier, but so much of this is governed by nudges, winks and understandings, that if a Prime Minister cannot pass a Queen's Speech, then effectively their government effectively has no confidence there. But under the terms of the law as it stands, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, the government cannot be compelled to resign unless a motion of no confidence has been passed within it. So if the government doesn't pass the Queen's Speech, and there's clearly a majority in Parliament against them, which is why this haggling with the DUP is so important, Theresa May could potentially face a vote of no confidence at any time. But as anyone who remembers 1976 to 79 remembers, majority governments can be tenacious. They can survive day to day. And I think this legislative agenda as it stands reflects that the Tories are hunkering down for a long term as a minority.
But then, as you point out, there aren't many governments that have to cope with the complexities of what's going on with Brexit and the eight massive bills that have to pass through the House.
Absolutely.
And both houses.
And one of the things that even the Great Repeal Bill itself, the government in the information issued, we've had a white paper on this already. We have had numerous statements to the House and select committee appearances by David Davis, some of which I've seen, and he has not specified the controversial point about how long the government will have the powers to amend existing legislation without consulting Parliament through what's called secondary legislation or statutory instruments. That's regulation-making power derived from primary legislation. That's going to be an enormously controversial fact. Now, no Parliament in its right mind is going to hand a government that kind of power, even if it had a majority. Are they going to hand a minority government the power to ignore them for an extensive period of time? Absolutely not. But that puts even greater pressure on what was meant to be one of the locked-in certainties of Brexit, giving us the legislative and regulatory framework to be a good starting point from which to begin our new relationship with the European Union.
Well, so many questions crowd into my mind. I mean, you think back just a couple of months, and the Tory party seemed more united almost than it had done for years, and the Labour Party as riven with dissension as you could possibly imagine. 2 months on, and the picture has switched completely.
Absolutely.
I mean, the Tories, at the slightest opportunity, will start tearing themselves to pieces. They seem to be sort of holding pretty much together at the moment. Nobody is sort of a prime minister or a Conservative leader in waiting. Boris has ruled himself out. So what do we think is going to happen? Will they manage to sort of sit on their hands for a while and see what May does?
I think they're already counting it down. They're just waiting for someone who's brave enough to break cover. The person who does will probably not be the one who wins the leadership, but I have in my mind there will be some point down the road where a certain cabinet minister or two will probably express doubt in what she is doing in the course of action she does. She has had to let go of an enormous amount of control now, and she'll have to rely much more on her cabinet colleagues, people who she's kept very much under her thumb for the last 11 months, primarily through Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. Philip Hammond will be able...
They've both gone.
They've both gone, absolutely. Philip Hammond will have far more influence as well. I suspect he'll probably be the kingmaker figure in this as well. I could... unless there is a major economic catastrophe, Brexit looks set to continue as is. What I would anticipate happening is that she will be quietly pressured from behind the scenes to timetable a departure date to give the Conservatives time to build up to another election, because I don't think anybody wants the government to go through the next 2 years of negotiations, less than that now, without a working majority in Parliament.
Well, let's look at some of the other parties, though. The Lib Dems are better than they did before, though perhaps not as well as they were hoping. The SNP, well, they would argue wonderful election, but everybody else would argue really didn't have a great time. But it's Labour, perhaps, that is most interesting. I mean, beforehand, we had a leader of a party who was disliked by almost all his parliamentary members. Now, even the ones who really did not want to come behind Jeremy Corbyn, they all seem to be sort of falling in line and thinking that they can work with him now. Now they realise he's not an electoral liability.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, including myself, have had to be a great deal of humble pie when it comes to Jeremy Corbyn here. And I was chatting to a friend of mine last night, and I think I often perhaps am guilty of underestimating just how appealing he is to the people who really believe that he represents a change in politics. I should say that he had a good campaign, but the expectations for this were very, very low. But Labour did gain seats in places they did not have them before. But let's be clear, they fought the Conservatives to a draw at this election at best, and they still got fewer seats, and they still got fewer votes. Mm. Now, I suspect if things were reversed tomorrow, Jeremy Corbyn would probably be in Downing Street right now, and there's still a very good chance he will be our next Prime Minister. It's hard to see how the Conservatives recover from this, but they are victims. Let's be clear, not really so much of Mr Corbyn's success, although he has raised turnout among younger voters, but more of their own complacency for ignoring a generation of people, particularly the under 40s, and having very little to offer them in terms of what many people might see as a positive vision for their future. Because don't forget, as much as Brexit people say may have been voted for by people of the over 65s, it's the under 40s that are really going to have to deal with it, particularly those people who are 18 to 24 at the moment. This is their future, and Jeremy Corbyn offered them, whilst the vision lacking in Brexit detail, a more appealing alternative than many people envisioned.
I was intrigued. I mean, I had a discussion with my own daughter and with some Labour friends, and you know, they seem very attracted by the idea of abolition of tuition fees. And absolutely, in vain did I point out that not only was it Labour that had introduced them, but it was Tony Blair who was the one who actually wanted 50% of students to go to university. But memories are relatively short, perhaps.
Well, people remember 2010. They remember. They think tuition fees. They think the trebling of them now. And I, you know, when I left university, I know people who pay one generation within 3 years of each other. One of them's on 1,500, one of them's on 3,000, one of them's on 9,000. I mean, that's absurd. But it was it was a policy designed,
and all at 3% above the inflation rate. And I mean, it's very expensive loan.
It is, and it would be an expensive policy to implement. But I think this one thing is clear is that people are tiring now of the spreadsheet economics of running the country, of hearing the words austerity and there isn't enough money in this and that. And I think if we've learned one thing really from the sad situation with Grenfell Tower is that our services at local government level are extraordinarily underinvested and unable to cope with when inevitably, albeit exceptional, incidents of tragedy happen. When Theresa May herself said earlier on the day we're recording this, this is a failing of the state. And unfortunately, it is the Conservatives who have run the state for the last 7 years and pursued an agenda, whether you believe it to be rightly or wrongly, to put fiscal consolidation at the front of the national agenda or not, which has taken money out of the national coffers at a time when many people think we need to be spending it.
So a very uncertain time. Many other European nations do run themselves fairly well without a majority government. Is the problem then for Theresa May and the Conservatives the fact that we just have a different political system? We're not used. I mean, Angela Merkel, for instance, doesn't have a majority, but Germany still runs fairly well. Is it just our political system not able to cope with this fragmentation?
I think one of the things that disappointed me most about Jeremy Corbyn's agenda in this is that he is opposed to voting reform in this regard. And this election, unfortunately, isn't going to move away from what Nick Clegg called the duopoly of British politics. The two parties here obtained the highest share of the vote for 20-something years. I think it's 25 years since 1992. I think it was up from like two-thirds at the last election to 82% this time round. They squeezed the smaller parties. Now, the SNP are geographically distorted because of where they are. Their share of the vote gives them disproportionately more seats. The Lib Dems, weirdly enough, their share of the vote went down, but the number of seats went up because of geographic concentration. Similarly, why Mr Corbyn took seats like Canterbury, like Kensington, seats which no Labour person would normally have expected to happen. Fundamentally, I think that the longer-term issue is, in the shorter term, governments are going to have to learn to work across party lines more often. And fundamentally, the leader who proposes doing away with first-past-the-post with either Labour or the Conservatives will be somebody who has in mind a more European style of politics, which will allow smaller parties more influence, yes, and that will include UKIP, it will include the Lib Dems, it will include the SNP, it will include the Greens. And that fundamentally will give us a more stable system of government going forward, I think. But at the moment, with this election result, there's no incentive because both leaders hold out the hope that they can get those magic words of "I've got a majority."
Yes, we did, of course, have the AV referendum. I'm trying to remember what year that was. 2011. Gosh, that's like a lifetime ago. Mike Indian, political commentator, author of the Groucho Tendency blog. Thank you very much indeed.
The bigger picture. Going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.